student in the 1970s. I had the privilege to hear his class on economics of the family while he was writing the treatise. It was the very first time he taught the course, so that was a very special opportunity. He was very excited about it. And I hope we will have many more opportunities to interact with him at various conferences. Thank you.
merging of the two people into one unit that makes decisions together. I would just say one more thing is that Bob has also been influential as editor of the International Economic Review, and it's not a coincidence that that review published the first two bargaining models in economics, Manzer and Brown 1980 and McElroy and Horney 1981. These were papers that Bob ridiculed while he was the editor of the International Economic Review, and so he already had early on prior to 1980 an interest in this field. Bob has also written a whole lot of other bargaining models of the family, and I refer you to his webpage for more information. The webpage is very organized, and it's a pleasure to introduce Bob.
Household production, marriage markets, and switch. nothing about the economics of the family. When I left MIT in 1964, I was not hostile to the economics of the family. I was simply ignorant of it. Paul Samuelson, who was the dominant figure in economics at MIT, was dismissive of the economic approach to fertility. In the mid-1970s, Samuelson wrote a paper that's better described as mathematical demography than economic demography. And in it, he wrote rather disparagingly of, quote, the rather sterile verbalizations by which economists have tended to describe fertility decisions in terms of the jargon of indifference curves, thereby tending to intimidate non-economists who have not misspent their youth in mastering the intricacies of modern fertility theory. And he followed that with a footnote making it clear that Gary was his target. The question implicitly posed by Samuelson, and I think this was one of Samuelson's major misjudgments, the question implicitly posed was whether economists should study the family, or whether this was something better left to sociologists. And Samuelson clearly thought it was better left to sociologists, and we all know that Gary, in addition to being professor of economics at the University of Chicago, is also a professor of sociology. So his influence has spread to sociology, and sociology now looks very different than it did in 1960. I can testify from direct personal experience that ideas which, in retrospect, seem obvious, were not at all obvious at the time. I'll say something about an example of that from Becker's paper on the allocation of time, the 1965 paper on the allocation of time, which is a remarkable paper, and Mike Walker and I wrote a paper criticizing some aspects of it. I won't describe that paper in detail. In fact, I won't describe it at all. But I will say that in that paper, Becker suggested in a paragraph that the long, first of all, let me say, that is the paper which talks about a one-person household. It is not the analysis of specialization that appears in the second chapter of the Treatise on the Family. There is a brief section, one paragraph, that talks about the allocation of time within the family. Just a paragraph. And anyone who read the article in retrospect should have picked up on that and realized there was a paper to be written. In fact, of course, Gary wrote it, and no one else picked it up from this 1965 paper. These themes were not at all obvious at the time to many of us. Historically, some of the initial hostility to Becker's work reflected, I think, Samuelson's view that the family was simply not a suitable subject for economic analysis. And on that, Becker has clearly won the day. And this conference and the strength of the paper being presented here are a testament to the success of Becker's program. So what is there left to disagree about? A lot. Most of us, most economists, I think, who disagree with Becker, are unlikely to reject the foundational assumptions of maximizing behavioral equilibrium. That's what we do. That's the way we think about the world. So when we disagree, as I said, we often do, the disagreements are almost always about auxiliary assumptions that must be made in order to construct particular rules. Again, for example, if we assume that spouses' time in household production, spouses' time in input into household production is perfect substitutes, that's going to lead us fairly directly to a theorem about specialization. The assumption that spouses' time is in production is perfect substitutes is a very strong secondary or tertiary auxiliary assumption. We get results from it, but we should be really hesitant about assuming it. And in fact, Becker, although he uses it to motivate his discussion of time allocation, does not assume it in any of his theorems about specialization within the household. My point is that the foundational assumptions of maximizing behavior and equilibrium need to be supplemented by a range of other assumptions. Household production is what I would think of as a primary auxiliary assumption, a really crucial assumption in the economics of the family. But beyond that, one needs to make some assumptions about the structure of household production in order to derive results. The assumption that spouses' time inputs are perfect substitutes is a bridge too far. The question is, what should we be assuming? What is a good, fruitful assumption about the structure of household production? And it's that set of issues, that kind of issue that I want to talk about in the context of three specific topics, bargaining, models of the marriage market, and time use. We'll see how far I get. And Shoshana is keeping time. Bargaining and families. In the treatise, what we have, among other things, is the altruist model, which I won't describe in any detail, but I characterized the altruist model elsewhere as one figure in the household, the husband, father, dictator, patriarch, gets to make all the decisions. And the question is, what is the underlying model that leads to that? I won't talk in any detail about that particular model. I simply want to say that that is what we would call a unitary model, in the sense that an implication of that is that the altruist's utility function is maximized subject to the family's overall resource constraint. And that's a very strong statement, a strong claim. And it's a claim that has empirical content. What it implies is that lump sum transfers of resources within the household will have no effect. It implies what's called the pooling hypothesis. And that in itself was an important discovery. It took a long time for people to realize that the unitary model implied pooling, and that pooling provides a simple, transparent test of the unitary model. And that was realized in the early, I think in 1990, published papers by Margie McElroy, by Duncan Thomas, and by Paul Schultz. Shelley Lundberg and Terry Wells and I came back to that in the mid-1990s with a paper that turned on the natural experiment provided by the British Child Allowance, where essentially what Margaret Thatcher did was to transfer money from the wallet to the purse, as this was described, from men to women. And what we found was that there was a substantial increase in expenditure on children's clothing relative to men's clothing, and a substantial increase in expenditure on women's clothing relative to men's clothing. That's important evidence that control over resources matters. The transfers of resources within the family has an impact on expenditure matters. And I think that paper has been fairly powerful in leading to a rejection of the unitary model. This does not push us to a particular bargaining model. What it does is to suggest there's a serious problem with the unitary model. And then the question is, what can we replace it? Shoshana mentioned the papers in the IPR in the early 1980s by Anser and Brown and by McElroy and Horning, which I was very pleased to accept. Those are what are called divorce threat bargaining models. They're cooperative Nash bargaining models in which the threat point is divorce. Shelley Lundberg and I proposed the separate spheres bargaining model in the 1993, which essentially postulates that the threat point is internal to the marriage, arguing that divorce may well not be a credible threat if you're better off within the marriage than you need to get divorced. The divorce is an outside option, but not really a plausible starting point for bargaining. Pierre-André Chiappori's elegant collective model characterizes whole plate of issued allocations in terms of distribution factors, and therefore includes all cooperative bargaining models within that, and many non-cooperative bargaining models that lead to trade of efficient outcomes as special cases. And that's one of the really few general results in the economics of the family. If you think about the treatise and the results there, most of them depend on a lot of very special assumptions. And this is true. I don't mean to say this is simply true of the treatise on the family. This is true of my own work with Shalit Lundberg, a bunch of my own work on the family with Jerry Barron and Paul Taubman. What is really very satisfying about the collective model is that it is a general result. And if you ask, what are the other general results out there, there are very, very few. So it seems to me that the bargaining in families has been a great success in terms of what we've learned. We actually know more than we did. And the Becker really started us on this path by making very strong assumptions, strong and refutable assumptions. And that seems to be a very important characteristic of the work. As Jordan said, Gary is not afraid to make strong assumptions. Let me say something about the marriage market in much the same spirit. And this is material from my solely presidential address a few years ago. Becker is certainly right about the importance of the marriage market. It matters in terms of who marries. It matters in terms of who marries whom. More generally, we want to go beyond the marriage market, I think, to ask questions about who's making babies for whom. But the whole set of issues there about the sort of matching are extremely important. What we need in order to proceed is an auxiliary assumption in order to model the marriage market. What Becker assumes is that when prospective spouses meet in the marriage market, they can make binding agreements about distribution in marriage. The strong assumption. We're not talking now about prenuptial agreements about dividing things when they get divorced. What we're talking about is making agreements about how things are likely to divide in an ongoing marriage. And that assumption, binding agreements in the marriage market, everyone meets everyone else right away, no information problems, leads you quite directly to the Koopman's Beckman assignment. The implication of that is that in equilibrium, the surplus over all possible marriages is maximized. It's not that the best man necessarily marries the best woman, but it's the surplus over all possible marriages that's maximized. And in effect, there are side things. Bargaining within marriage when that story becomes unnecessary. Notice also that the Alphonse model becomes unnecessary then. That the models in the treatise don't necessarily fit together perfectly. If you have binding agreements in the marriage market, you don't need the Alphonse model. But there's an alternative assumption, which I would argue is more plausible, and that is that spouses can make binding agreements in the marriage market. But spouses can, when they meet, recognize that they're going to play a bargaining game during marriage. And going a step further, they can foresee the outcome of that game. They can forecast. The implication of that, notice, is that a man who wants a woman to marry him can't promise her a larger share than she thinks she would get in bargaining. She knows that's cheap talk, and she knows it's not enforceable. Given that structure, each man has a ranking of all women, but he knows what he's going to get in every possible marriage. Each woman has a ranking of all men. She knows what she's going to get in each possible marriage. That's an interesting setup. That's precisely the setup of Gale and Chapman in their 1962 paper, College Admissions and the Stability of Marriage. cite for this. What are the implications? One implication is that the set of equilibrium marriages does not maximize surplus over all possible marriages. Another is that it accommodates non-marriage very easily. And in particular, it's easy to see how you can have an unmarried man and an unmarried woman who, between them, could produce a surplus, which, if they divided it right, could make them both better off than they would be unmarried. But because she knows that she's going to get the short end of the stick if they marry, she won't marry him. And notice that there is no way he can promise her the share that would maintain the marriage. These are different views. Again, what we're talking about are auxiliary assumptions, the kind of assumptions you need to make a model run. And we have a choice here between binding agreements in the marriage market versus no agreements in the marriage market. One set of assumptions leads you to coupons, that would be the assignment model, the other to Gale Chapel and matching models. It would be nice to have more empirical evidence on these questions. Let me turn now to the third topic, namely time use and specialization. And this is recent work that I've been doing. Looking back at the specialization points that Becker makes in the Treatise on the Family, what Becker claims is that efficiency implies what I would call sector specialization. This is a theoretical point. This is not an empirical point, primarily, although one can look at data and ask, do we see sector specialization of the sort that Becker derives from the five specialization theorems in Chapter 2 of the Treatise? But what Becker is looking at is a model in which there are two sectors, home and market. Spouses allocate time, and let me avoid some messy issues about the precise meaning of specialization by instead focusing on the meaning of non-specialization. What non-specialization means is that both spouses work in the market and both spouses work at home. So what I'm going to talk about is non-specialization. And what is claiming in his theorems is that efficiency implies specialization. Notice that if Becker's theoretical claim is true, then I think we would have to conclude that in the U.S. most married couple households are inefficient, because we do observe husbands and wives who both work in the market and work in the household. But again, I'm not making an empirical point, I'm making a theoretical point. The question is, where did these results come from? What assumptions are driving this conclusion? The key assumption, in fact, is what I would call an additivity assumption. It's an assumption that if both the husband and the wife work at home, the output they produce from the time she works at home and the time he works at home is going to be equal to the sum of the outputs they would produce if she spent that much time at home producing her output and he spent that much time at home producing his output. It's an additivity assumption. We simply add together these separate outputs they produce. Now, the additivity assumption is a well-known assumption. It's a standard assumption in Ricardian models of international trade. If we think about England producing cloth and Portugal producing wine, we don't think very much about any more complicated technology. And if we imagine both England and Portugal producing cloth, world output will simply be the sum of English output and Portuguese output. The question is that a plausible assumption for household production? Suppose we don't make the additivity assumption, and by the way, Becker does not mention the additivity assumption. This is an implicit assumption. Suppose we thought, for example, that husband's time and wife's time were compromised in household production. Suppose supposed to take a very extreme case that we have a fixed coefficient of Leontief technology. Then it's clear we don't get any output at all unless both of them are spending time in household production. Now, that's true in the fixed coefficient case. Notice it's also true in the top governance case. But the time of both spouses in those two special cases is essential to production. But we can weaken that very substantially and ask what would happen if the time of both spouses is not essential, but simply complementary. And it's easy to construct examples where, when time is complementary, we get non-specialization. The specialization conclusion, the argument for specialization, rests on the additivity assumption, which is a very plausible assumption for Ricardian models of international trade, not a little plausible assumption for household production. Becker also has an argument about the role of human capital in household production, an argument that actually depends rather crucially on household human capital that's specific to the household sector, as opposed to general human capital. That is, the story doesn't work if general human capital increases productivity in the market and general human capital and education increases productivity at home. What he needs is sector-specific human capital that people are investing in. On the other hand, it can't be too specific because if we relax the assumption of two sectors, or if we expand the household sector to consider more than one household activity, the story looks very different. If we consider a model with a market and two household activities, it's easy to construct examples where efficiency manifests itself with one spouse engaged in one activity, in one household activity, the other spouse in the other household activity, and both working in the market. And that, of course, is not consistent with sector specialization, with essentially husbands in the market and wives at home. That's a slightly unfair characterization of specialization, because one spouse can be in both sectors. It's just that both spouses can't be in both sectors. Let me, before I conclude, just mention a few topics that I think have not gotten enough attention in the literature, and this, of course, is a somewhat idiosyncratic list. One is bargaining power. I don't think we know enough about the determinants of bargaining power, or in terms of the collective model, about the distribution factors. The collective model is silent about where the distribution factors come from. Most of the explicit bargaining models simply make an assumption about what bargaining power is and where it comes from. So it would be nice if there were a curative part of this to look more systematically at alternative sources of bargaining power. Pareto efficiency. It would be really nice to know more about Pareto efficiency in the household. Shelley Lundgren and I have argued that given the inability or unwillingness of spouses to make binding agreements, that we might expect inefficiency to arise when households have to make large upfront decisions that affect future bargaining power. The story Shelley and I tell is what we call the two-earner couple location problem. That is, I have a really attractive offer in New York. My wife has a really attractive offer in Los Angeles. I can't commit not to exploit the bargaining power I would gain if we moved to New York. She can't commit to refrain from exploiting the bargaining power she would gain if we moved to Los Angeles. As a result, we may stay in St. Louis, even though that's inefficient. We argue that that's an interesting model to think about in a variety of contexts, including fertility, where big upfront decisions are going to affect bargaining power in the future in a predictable way. The marriage market, as I said before, I'd like to know more about that. Asymmetric information in families and households. Becker, as I mentioned, has a chapter about divorce. Marriage divorce under that rubric, I include immigration, migration, co-residence, and proximity. The proximity part, I think, is relatively novel for economists. Immigration and migration are major topics in labor economics. There is virtually no contact between those discussions and the economics of value. People simply do not talk about family aspects of migration very much. And I think that needs to be redone. There is a bit of work, but really surprisingly, what we do typically is to model migration decisions as driven by labor market factors, by wage rates, unemployment rates, and so on. A little bit of attention to amenities. What we're typically talking about are isolated individuals making location decisions. Co-residents. We all know that who lives with whom is endogenous. The place where we pay attention to that is when we talk about marriage. But there are a number of other places where co-residence is interesting and worth thinking more about. One is the question of relatively young adults who continue to live at home, who move back home. This has become much more important in light of the Great Recession. There's been a substantial increase in multi-generational housing. The other place where there's a lot of interest in co-residence is in the context of long-term care of the disabled. More generally, I think, long-term care of the disabled. Who lives near whom is also endogenous? And there's remarkably little thinking about proximity. But in terms of long-term care, which is how I came to think about this issue initially, it's reasonably clear that having a son or daughter, an adult son or daughter who lives down the block is probably a pretty good substitute for co-residents. And the long-term care literature is really just starting to think about that. But in terms of theory, proximity arises in our models as an unintended consequence of migration decisions that are made on a purely individualistic basis. And that's a distinctly odd assumption. Janice Compton and I have some recent work in which we find that the labor force attachment of married women with young children is substantially increased by close geographical proximity to her mother and her mother-in-law. But people simply have not looked at this, and most of our data sets, in fact, will not let you look at both her mother and her mother-in-law. Let me switch now to another topic, final topic. And with what I'll call complex families, complex households, and family structure. What Becker does in the treatise on family is essentially to focus on traditional nuclear families. A household with mom, dad, their joint children, but no stepchildren. And again, just to be clear, that I'm living in a glass house. This Jerry Gammon and I have work on investment in children's human capital, and we make that assumption implicitly. This is the default assumption in economics. It's not a viable default assumption in the modern world. You can't talk to sociologists and make that assumption. Non-marital fertility is real, blended families are real, and we want to be thinking about allocation and investment in children's human capital in these other family types. And those other family types look much more complicated. Or other household types is perhaps the way to put that, because I also want to make a pitch for thinking about the family beyond the household. If we wanted to model investment in human capital in a single parent family, let's think about a mother and family, mom and her child. The way we would almost, I suspect most of us would start by doing that is to think she's making the decisions and that's it. What about the father? We have a lot of evidence from fragile families among those sources that there's plenty of interaction between mom and the father. how these decisions about investment in human capital are in fact made. The other players here are likely to be the mom's parents, the maternal grandparents, who may well be playing a role in decisions about the child, even though they are not living in the same household. And it seems to me that you know very little about the family beyond the household. One of the few papers I can point to as an exception is the Weiss and Willis paper that looks at child support payments by absent non-custodial parents. But with the exception of that paper, there is very little about the family beyond the household. Where does this leave us? It's amazing how far we've come in the economics of the family. If we measure it as the 30 years since the publication of the treatise, or in the 50 or so years since Becker's first article on fertility that appeared in 1960. The papers of this conference are a testament to the success and vitality of Becker's vision of the economic approach to the family. The foundational assumptions of maximizing behavior and equilibrium are enormously powerful and are the foundation of the economics of the family. Becker showed that it's possible to build powerful models of family behavior using the tools of microeconomics. Building models required auxiliary assumptions, of course, and that's precisely what Becker did. Some of the primary auxiliary assumptions, for example, household production, are now central to the economics of the family. It's hard to imagine how we would do the economics of the family without that. But some of the secondary and tertiary auxiliary assumptions, for example, assumptions about the structure of household technology, or about binding agreements in the marriage market, are very much debatable and contested. So as we examine these contested secondary and tertiary auxiliary assumptions, the issues, it seems to me, are more likely to turn on empirical evidence than on a priori for the rest of it. So to sum up, I'm proud to acknowledge myself as both a follower of Becker and a critic of Becker. Criticism, however, should not be understood as heresy. After all, we are not theologians, we are economists. And thank you very much.
Samson's comments about Becker. I mean, they raise a fascinating problem for me, or a puzzle in the sort of history of thought of household economics, because, of course, I like to refer to Samson's paper in 1956 on social indifference curves, where he has a section saying, well, you know, the family is a social group, and you can apply this theory directly to families. And I know in a paper you call that a sort of throwaway comment, but I just see it as a sort of concise, not further developed comment that you know. But in one sense, that was also a foundational kind of paper on the economics of the household, the economics of the family. It's an extremely puzzling to me why he should then have been so negative about Becker's work, because he should have welcomed it. Okay, it was a Chicago kind of partial equilibrium price theory approach, not a general equilibrium MIT approach, so to speak. But nevertheless, you know, he was applying microeconomics to the analysis of the house. So for me, it's a great puzzle why Samson would have been so negative about Becker's contribution.
My interpretation is that Samuelson simply wasn't interested in that. That he was doing this paper on international trade and talking about countries having indifference curves. And his point was, you can't assume countries have indifference curves. There's an aggregation issue there. And then what he said, he has a section, a brief section, a couple of pages, in which he says, this is an analogous problem in the household. And then he goes back to international trade, and he never picked it up. And I think it reflects simply his lack of interest in these questions. And what Becker did was to realize that these are really interesting questions, and the tools of economics can help us know what's going on within the house. And I don't think
the list of topics you think we should be thinking about, I think is right on. I mean, it's exactly there. Just one thing I would add, actually, to the list, if I may, is that I think we really need to be exploring much more the role of love and affection, mutual respect, these sorts of things within the family. This is what really makes family economics different from, say, the economics of the labour market, employers and employees, or other situations where people interact. And I think that we still haven't really got a strong feeling. I think we've got a strong feeling for power, but we don't have a strong feeling for love, affection, and those sorts of things in the family.
I agree. I think. I haven't been working on this myself, but I take your point. It seems to me that Becker's notion of altruism, again, one can think about this as is a really good idea for a prime, or we can think of it as a primary auxiliary assumption that we can call altruism. But then you ask, how do you specify it? What do you mean by it? And what Becker eventually means by it is a kind of interdependent preferences where you care about the utility of other people. It's not obvious that that picks up what you want to pick up or what I want to pick up with altruism. And the question is, how can we model this? How can we think about this in some more interesting way? In terms of the Becker formulation of one person's utility is embedded in someone else's utility function, the problem with merit goods or paternalistic preferences is not the problem here. But it's not that we necessarily want to give our children what they say they want, because we know what's good for them. We have their welfare at heart. That's a different notion. And there are a whole set of issues here that I don't agree with, but I think they're important issues.
Can you respond to some of the points I made earlier?
Which ones in particular would you like response to? I'm happy with the notion of feminism. Particular point in the library.
So you're happy with that?